I think probably 99% of the NDAs ever signed in the games industry are totally ridiculous and could totally be dispensed with, because the ideas, you know, the underlying ideas are not.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the GameDevAdvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is Clark Stacey. He started back in the mid-90s at Beyond Games and has been developing games and leading teams at Wildworks for the last 17 years. Enjoy. Hey, Clark. So where are you calling in from tonight?
JP, I am calling from my basement home office, where I've been relegated to the base gym because my kids have Zoom piano lessons upstairs. That is, these are the bad news days that we live in.
Right. Yeah. It's you got to adapt and kind of roll with the punches there. So yeah. So you're based in Utah, right?
Yeah, we're in Salt Lake City. Studios just south of downtown Salt Lake City. But yeah, we've been here for going on 18 years now.
Wow, that's fantastic. So COVID-19, how's it going with that and everything with the studio and workflow and just life in general?
You know, I think like a lot of people in the industry have been pleasantly surprised by how quickly we adapted and how well. You know, I think maybe we had half a day of downtime in, you know, some artists lugging their Cintiqs home and you know, some of the hardware setup stuff, but really it was pretty quick. Where we're noticing the difference, so you know, we were just in the process of launching a new game called Feral. And, you know, everybody was up to speed on that. Everybody's passionate about it. Easy to kind of keep doing what we were doing and do it remotely. What's hard is that now we're getting back into kind of our usual flow of prototyping new ideas and looking to see what comes out of that prototype process and doing like, you know, innovation days, and game jams and things. That's when it gets hard. When you're, so we've got a couple of concepts that have been on the back burner that now we're trying to get some pre-production done on. We're kicking around design ideas and game loops, all that stuff that you really want to gather around a whiteboard for.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So I was thinking the big whiteboard and markers and people pointing and saying, what about this, and drawing over things and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the ways that we prototype game loops is we'll make physical games out of it. You know, we'll take we'll take a game concept or a battle mechanic or a, you know, collection mechanic or something and turn it into physical 3D game pieces and play it live. That's that kind of dynamic, sort of synergistic. You don't know what you're missing in there until it's gone, right? And there's only so much you can do over Zoom. You start to realize that the signal to noise ratio in you know, one-to-one interaction there, there's a lot that you're missing that doesn't get distilled through there. And I think it's the spontaneous, the organic, the off the cuff remark or idea that pops out that winds up being gold. And there's just something too stilted about, a video conference for that to kind of organically emerge. So we're doing well production wise. We're on top of milestones. We're on top of content coming out, but feeling the pain when it comes to conceptualizing new stuff.
Yeah, because that human interaction and those nuances and communication that you do in person that doesn't quite translate over video cameras.
It really is that whole gather around the whiteboard thing, which, design wise, I don't think that's changed from the earliest days of the industry. That's still how it gets done. And a lot of it is just, you know, people riffing together and kicking around ideas. It's like a writer's room for television or mm-hmm. something. It's you know, a lot of it's stuff that just kind of comes out of the hive mind there. And yeah. That's what I'm worried. And it's not the stuff that you feel in the first few months of quarantine, but you know, I think we're going to start to see it across the industry and hear more people talking about it mm-hmm. as this wears on into a second year.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great point. Well, speaking about the company, tell me about your current role as the longstanding CEO there at Wildwork.
So yeah, we started this company, myself and two co-founders, Jeff Amos and Chris Johnson, mm-hmm. Back in 2003. We started it originally, it was called Smart Bomb Interactive. And, you know, we were thinking that the objective was action games. And, you know, Chris and I had been operating a studio that he started called Beyond Games for 10 years.
Okay.
Prior to that, where we were doing a lot of vehicle combat, a lot of action games. And we kind of thought that was the direction that that Smart Bomb was going to go. And we wound up kind of finding our niche in kids games. Mm-hmm. And we'd come to this from having developed our own engine and kind of having the production values of having done console games for a long time. And
right.
We looked at how bad the games were for kids that were out there. Mm-hmm. It was just that stuff that whenever a new animated movie comes out,
right.
some poor studio gets, you know, 6 months to do 5 SKUs and
slap in a box and make the date and to be damned with the quality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hope everything on the box is spelled right. So you can get it on the shelves of Walmart in time for Christmas. Right.
Yeah.
And as long as the box doesn't catch on fire and it actually boots up, then, you know, that was about all the quality you could guarantee.
Yeah.
We looked at that and thought, well, God, if this is where the quality bar is for kids games, we can blow this out of the water.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. What's Steph Insert doing some of this? So, mm-hmm. We started doing, some work for hire stuff, like a lot of fledgling studios do. And, did some stuff with Namco Bandai, mm-hmm. With Activision Value, and a bunch of companies. You know, there at the time, you know, it was like THQ and Midway and Activision Value. They were generating all of these kids products,
right?
And none of them are around anymore.
No, I was at Midway. I remember the Happy Feet and all that stuff that we were doing. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Not to cast aspersions on anything that you worked on there, man.
No. I was on the violent stuff with Mortal Kombat. I was in a different world. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we can diss on the Happy Feet team all the way. I never played it though. But yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, man. Totally.
That's kind of where we were when the recession hit in 2008 and the iPhone mm-hmm. hit in 2007. Then, you know, all those companies basically went away and we had to kind of retrench and say, okay, we're going to have to make a pivot here. And we think it ought to be to our own IP. Mm-hmm. And so we started work on what eventually became Animal Jam, which we launched in 2010.
Yeah.
And now that's
a popular game, right? I mean, it's still going and 10 years later and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. Still going and still growing, kind of cool. Amazingly. Since then, the company's grown. We've had offices in different places. Right now we've got a team of awesome engineers in Pune, India. We have, mm-hmm. 85, 90 people here at the headquarters in Salt Lake.
Okay.
We have a moderation and support team in the Philippines. Mm. Primarily development and conceptualization is done here in Salt Lake. So, I've been the CEO since 2015. My role, when we're small and nimble, I'm doing a lot of design work. Now that we're bigger and have IPs that are in multiple languages. I'm doing a lot more of the grown-up stuff. It's fun.
You mentioned Beyond Games. So, like, how did you actually get started in the industry?
Well, I was fortunate when I was an undergraduate at the University of Utah. The job that I did throughout college was I started first as a bouncer and later as a bartender at this nightclub in downtown Salt Lake.
Okay.
That turned out to be owned by this absolutely brilliant self-taught programmer. Whose dream since childhood had been making video games, and he owns this club, and did some of it. But pretty much, what he wanted to spend all his time on was working on his game ideas. Okay. So he used to bring builds of whatever he'd been working on into the bar after we closed, and so we'd lock the doors, pull the curtains, open up the taps, and play his latest build until the sun came up.
That's awesome.
Which was a lot of fun. I helped him out with a few things during that period, but thought that I was going to be going into more of an academic career. I was. Started doing teaching at the University of Utah and was ramping up for grad school there. And it pretty quickly realized that what he was doing looked like a lot more fun than what I was doing. pivot exactly. So I came and joined there full time, became an owner along with him, and we did a series of games mostly about blowing shit up. And
and when was this? Like what roughly time frame?
That's beyond. He started Beyond Games in like 1992. Okay. The first game that. That came out under that label that I had anything to do with was for the Atari Lynx. Really dates me. And then we did a fighting game. I know you've got some history in this. We did a fighting game for the Jaguar that we combined live green screen characters with stop motion animated characters and CG characters. I one of the live characters along with another bouncer at the bar, and we shot all of the footage for that at the bar on the same stage where bands were going to be playing that night. And we just we hung up green screen over the stage and kind of figured out how to do this. It was very
roll your own.
It was very roll your own and kind of figure it out as we go along. We didn't, never done anything like that before, but we figured it out and game came out.
That's awesome. So now looking back, what do you wish you had known when you had started in the industry?
What really got me excited early on about games. So I was studying in the languages and literature department at the University of Utah. I was working with a professor up there on a couple of books, on one on Greek and Roman athletics, one on Greek mythology, and helping him teach in the classics department. And I really got sucked into the muds and mushes that were taking off at the time. So these were text-based RPGs, right? And I don't know that people, if you've never played one or if you don't, you weren't kind of there for when it seemed so radical, this idea that you were playing in real time with all these people from all over the world.
Yeah.
It was just mind blowing, even though it was just text, it was incredibly vivid. And, between that and like the BBS game scene was big at the time. And,
okay.
This was before the World Wide Web.
And, right. Yeah. The modem handshakes and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So, if you were looking for information on the internet, you were looking in Gopher and, IRC and things like that.
Yeah.
But that really got me excited about the ability to tell stories through this medium and to create worlds in this medium. What I wish that we'd had then are some of the tools that are available now to
Unity,
from
stuff like that.
From Scratch for kids up through Unity, to have access to something like that for free. God, that's just—it's staggering.
Right.
How you really get to start much further along than we did. There were no engines to license per se then. You needed to find some fairly badass engineers to
John Carmack.
Tim Sweeney's. Those were everybody's heroes. Because they can write a V rendering engine. Fortunately, we had one of those in Chris, but that means that if you're able to persuade a publisher or somebody else to fund your project, you've got 6 months of hard work before you can show anything of remotely interesting on screen.
Right.
You can do that in a weekend now with Unity.
In terms of someone looking to get their first job right now, like what kind of advice would you give someone trying to break into the industry?
This isn't a popular thing for me to say when I'm speaking at colleges and universities, and I should qualify it by saying that the university programs, there's a lot of value that you get out of that.
Yeah.
And it is a great way to build your portfolio, but frankly, it's all portfolio. Somebody gives me a resume, I skip over the education stuff. I'm looking for the portfolio link.
Right. ArtStation, really seeing what the work looks like. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Deviant or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. For art, for animation, even for design and scripting and that, that's what matters. You come to us with a PhD in computer science from Harvard, but no portfolio, we're going to pass by you to talk to the guy who's been putting together an awesome portfolio of his own projects in his garage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It shows that initiative, right? You can do stuff your own, and you've got that fortitude to complete things.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, the engineering talent, especially that we're chasing now, when I started out, game development engineers were a fairly specialized bunch. There wasn't a lot of competition for people doing 3D rendering and, AI for games any of the collision systems, any of the stuff that went into game technology then.
Right.
We were only competing with other game companies when it came to that talent.
Mm-hmm.
Now the engineers that are most in demand are infrastructure guys and cloud networking guys and security. The same people that banks and healthcare systems and lots of boring businesses want to hire.
Yeah.
So what differentiates you if you want to work in the games industry is a passion for games.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want to just hire somebody for whom a job at a healthcare company or a bank would be just as interesting.
Yeah, and to be honest, sometimes too, those places pay more, right? So it's like banks offer the big bucks, and people are going to go there. So you want to see somebody that's passionate about games and has done some work on their own.
Those are the best, and that is one of the great things about some of the university programs now. And I know we have some common connections at the University of Utah's master's program in game development, which I think is one of the best in the country.
Yeah, I agree.
But when we see candidates from there, we actually participate. We go in, during the time that they're putting together and pitching what their master's projects will be.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in some of us from the industry locally, and we come in, we review the projects and give them some feedback. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. But what comes out of those programs are fully fleshed game development teams. Yeah, they're people that have already been working together for 6 months or a year.
Oh, right.
They have all of the major roles filled there. They've got, they've figured out how to get a team to gel together.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a producer, they've got designers, they've got animators, artists, engineers. They've done all the heavy lifting for forming a game company. If you're an angel investor and you want to play some bets, step in there. These guys have already done all of the heavy lifting, all the hard parts. Finding money isn't the hard part. It's getting the band together. Yeah. So when we're looking for talent now, we can bring an intern team in from a program like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're ready to hit the ground and make a game.
Yeah. So what about advice for someone, say trying to advance their career in design or production, kind of like some of the stuff you've done before your current role as CEO?
I don't know that I ever completely answered your question about how to get into the industry beyond saying that it's portfolio.
Yeah.
It is. It's portfolio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back in the days when I started out, the path into the industry was through QA, and it didn't matter.
Boot camp. Can you survive the gauntlet?
Exactly. Exactly. That was QA, and you show some aptitude for production, then you got on the producer track, and aptitude mm-hmm. for engineering, and you went on that track.
Yeah.
Now I think it's much more about what have you done. And while some people look at that as a barrier to, well, you know, how am I supposed to get a job in the industry if I haven't had a job in the industry? Mm-hmm. With the tools being so ubiquitous, so easy to obtain,
right,
there's no reason why anybody should walk into a game company without some stuff of their own that they've developed on their own and yeah. kind of shown that they cared enough about it to figure out how to do it. And it doesn't have to be gorgeous and polished. And, you know, nobody's looking at that and expect, you know, a Take-Two product or, something just that's ready to ship. Mm. It's more, you know, how did you approach the different problems that you hit here? And, so when you're talking about advancing your career or moving into different areas,
yeah,
I think about there's a test that we like to give prospective designers coming in at WildWorks.
Okay.
And we give them this box of stuff. And it's a mm-hmm. box that has some paper, it has some crayons, it has some dice, it has some poker chips,
okay,
and some action figures, just a bunch of random crap in there. Yeah. And we give them this box and we say, we're going to give you, say, 20, 30 minutes to design a game based on this with the stuff that's in this box. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to come back in here and we're all going to play it together.
Okay.
And, you know, that's not a lot of time to operate with that. You don't expect to come in and find that, oh, wow, they've created the next XCOM and it's right. it's brilliant.
Yeah.
What you expect is to see how they approach the problem solving that's involved there. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, having an idea for a game is the easy part.
Yeah, totally.
It's all of the millions of little problems that you encounter between that initial idea and how it's actually realized. Mm-hmm. And it's when you have to turn around and start thinking about it of, when I'm playing this, what's my objective? What is my core fantasy? What am I actually doing with my hands? What do I want the player to be looking at? And you can grapple with all those problems with a box of random crap. Mm-hmm. And it's more about seeing what's the problem solving approach. I think that the same is true in advancing your career in the industry. Mm-hmm. If you want to work in new areas or areas with more responsibility, it's demonstrating you've gone in and you've thought about the unique problems that you hit there and are kind of showing how you would solve them.
Yeah,
there's worker bees in every company, right? There's people who want to come in and do their job, be told what their job is and do it. And it's great. We need those. And some of those people are fantastically talented and they're happy doing what they're doing. But we also need people who are wanting to break out of what they're doing and try new stuff.
Right.
And those are the people that are looking around for problems and coming to us with solutions already. That's, you know, I think that's the best way to advance, probably in any company, but certainly in a game company, is mm-hmm. to identify bottlenecks or problems in the processes that you already have and not just point at them, come with solutions to them.
No, and that's came up before talking with people. It's be a problem solver, you know, make problems go away, come up with good ideas, be engaged.
The best players on any team are the ones that make everybody else look good. Mm-hmm. they're the Scottie Pippins, not just the Michael Jordan. It's the people who make everybody else's work more efficient or easier to do, or, you know, they're anticipating problem solving them in advance.
Yeah, to your other point, it's your portfolio and what kind of stuff you've done.
You're right, and there's so many venues now for indie developers or solo developers to show off their work and get feedback for their work and workshop it that didn't exist before, but indie game jams or game nights. And we pay attention to stuff like that. We love doing stuff like that internally.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I missed most about GDC this year, is I love going through the whole indie game hall there, and not just, looking at what people are doing, but talking to them about it and seeing their, passion and their energy for something that they've built. And there's nothing that they want more for somebody to actually pay some attention to it and ask them questions about it.
Yeah, that is a big part of GDC, and it's amazing how much hall space is dedicated to it, and all the kind of variety of stuff you can see, and not just even traditional games, but like physical games. And I saw people playing games with boxes and sticks and doing stuff. So there's all kinds of things there, and that definitely.
Yeah, there was some fun stuff last year. Somebody had a game that the controller was a sofa, and it was the game on screen was all controlled by people standing up and sitting down from the sofa. And it was, I love stuff like that. I love people who got freedom to just kind of think crazy thoughts and go do something, not because it's going to be a commercial success, but just because it's cool.
Mm-hmm. What's been like one or two of your favorite games or projects to work on over all these years?
Animal Jam has been incredibly rewarding. I was involved in the early design and the pre-production design of Animal Jam, but don't get involved very much anymore in design elements there.
Yeah.
The part that's fantastic about it is the community and the kids.
Okay.
It's, after 10 years of this community, we've seen kids who start out playing Animal Jam when they're 10, 11, 12 years old, and now they're graduating from college, and some of them are coming to work for us.
That's fantastic.
Others are sending us letters about how they're getting into science careers or careers in conservation and environmental protection because of the experiences they had in Animal Jam. That's fantastically rewarding. So
is that PC what platforms? Sorry to cut you off, but I was just
I've never played it. It's desktop and mobile. So kind of 360 degrees. From a design standpoint, some of the early games that I worked on when I was still figuring out how game design worked and just making mistakes and trying to find my way through them. I think the first game that I was lead design on was called Red Line, and it came out in 98 or 99. Okay. But it was the first in and out of vehicle combat game of its kind, where you could jump in and out of cars anytime, which sounds, it's kind of de rigueur now. It's pretty much any open world game has that. But at the time it was kind of radical. And that was sort of my game design grad school was that project. It was about a year of crunch time and 2.5 years of total development. It was brutal. I don't think physically I could go through it again, but it was very educational.
So it was an actual open world game, getting out of the cars
We tried to control environmentally when you could and couldn't, but for most of the game you could jump in and out,
and that opens a lot of doors from just both a design standpoint and then technical challenges and all that kind of stuff too, with streaming worlds and loading in the background and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and how do you draw a player through something like that? How do you tell a story when you there's an environment that you can either walk through or tear out, drive through, and you've still got to get the story points and the main action beats through the player. And there wasn't a lot for us to go on at the time in examples.
In terms of the industry, like, what are you curious about right now?
The Oculus Quest sold me on the idea of home VR. Mm-hmm. So
Facebook login requirement.
That sucks. And Facebook is toxic, and I wish that there was a divorce from that, and maybe the sideload homebrew community there is going to wind up being the saviors of the Quest. But it more as a proof of concept that you can have a device at or under $500 that doesn't require a $3,000 PC to run it.
Yep.
Doesn't require you to be tethered to anything, but can still be a very deeply immersive experience. That sold me on VR. I still don't know that there's, I don't have a lot of faith in Facebook's ability to market that. I think I think what they should have done from the very beginning is bought Beat Saber and packed it into every one of them and cut the price by about $200 because that's their Wii Sports.
Right. You know? Yeah, that's their Mario.
Their Wii Sports, their Mario. That's the thing that you get it as soon as you do it. And you know, the Wii had this challenge of what, it's these sticks and how am I supposed to play a racing game with this
strap on it and throw my controller.
But you pack it in with something simple that's kick ass and that everybody in the family immediately wants to try. And it's just intuitive. That's kind of, they have a couple of games like that. Beat Saber being, you know, a prominent one for it.
Right.
That, if you want to make this a mainstream entertainment device, you've got to have that as, you know, one leg of the stool, if not two of them. So I'm curious about where that goes from here. I hope that you know, there's other consumer electronics companies with the, I mean, there's, it's off the shelf parts that they're using there. There's nothing patented in the
Snapdragon chipset and all that kind of
So other people can and should and hopefully will be building these, and the prices will come down, the resolution will go up. It's still a little bulky for children to use. It kind of looks like a ski boot on a child's head, but it's getting better. And so I'm excited about that. AR fascinates me. We've got some AR functionality in the Animal Jam mobile game. That's a lot of fun to play around with.
Cool.
It's something that we're going to be doing with Feral as the mobile comes out. And I'm surprised that more people haven't seized on, you know, the Niantic technology that's licensable now and the Google Maps technology that's, you know, I think free, to do more location-driven stuff. Because, that's another one of those experiences that kind of takes people who don't consider themselves gamers and pulls them into an experience that kind of like a Wii Sports.
Yeah.
Like the grandma doesn't think that she's a gamer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was always like, tonight at the 10 o'clock news, grandma at the nursing home is playing video games. And, you know, the seniors playing and stuff. And yeah, just in terms of the Quest, like, I've always been very, very bullish on it and just excited just because of the price point, not the tethering, not $3,000 or $4,000 laptop. And just all those things were so exciting. And, you know, in the back of your mind, though, you're always like, well, what's Facebook going to do here? And then when that was announced and you had to use your Facebook login and everything, I was just like, oh man, I was deeply disappointed, but also not shocked. But at the same time, I was just like, oh, it just let a lot of the momentum out,
I know it does. And, you know, I think a lot of developers, us included, were kind of on the sidelines, in part because it was Facebook, in part because we kind of wanted to see, you know, when does this build up enough market viability to, how are you going to convince companies like mine to go and invest, you know, at least several hundred thousand dollars, probably millions, in game experience that's going to be competitive on that platform. When the installed base is X and the game price is Y, and you've got Facebook gobbling up a lot of that, they haven't really made a good case to third-party developers yet, and that's going to be the next step for that to grow.
Hey, hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, please go to patreon.com/gamedevadvice. We'd love to see if you can support the show and help new episodes keep coming out. That's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks.
Yeah, and what normally happens too is when people aren't embracing hardware, they got to back up the money truck and just start throwing money around to get developers on board.
You know. Has that ever worked? I mean, aside from the first party games,
Right.
That, you know, you buy Bungie so that you've got Halo for the Xbox, and okay, now you've got a titular property for your console. But
right.
I had so many, you know, from OnLive and Gekai and all the streaming companies back in the day that were raising tons of cash and giving it to developers to go and make games on their platform. Mm-hmm. None of that ever worked.
Yeah. It's more like a Hail Mary in some ways, right? Because I remember we did that TurboGrafx and TTI. It was like Nintendo was out there and Sega was a two-horse race. So they were trying to throw some money at devs to get some software on their platform. But yeah, it's definitely a long shot.
Another thing that I'm curious about, and you know, use this to give a shout out to my boy Tommy Tallarico, who's reviving the classic console.
I talked to him at GDC a year ago, and I got his card. I'm looking at it right now, and I'm like, when are you getting on the show? You know, because they're holding television, right?
Yeah, no, they've actually got an office here in Salt Lake now, and
okay, the date moved out, right? 2021. I saw
date moved out, but I don't know if you've seen the hardware. If he showed it to you at GDC,
no, he was just by the booth, and then we talked a little bit, but yeah,
it's cool. It really is. And I'm really curious because he's, you know, the whole pitch here is that this is inexpensive, easily accessible family gameplay. It's meant to be played in groups, and it's meant to, you know, it's not cutting edge 800 watt hardware, but does what it does and does it well. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of gamer friendly, you know, arcade sort of experiences for the play. I'm really curious to see how that does, because I think there's a market for it for sure. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, can you reach them and get to to a terminal velocity with that?
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what the first games are, because I love the idea and I want to see it work.
Probably 95% of these people listening right now have no idea what I'm talking about, but the Intellivision, you know, in its time, you know, that was my gateway drug into gaming. You know, besides the arcades, it was by that television, you know, the George Plimpton commercials, and you see the sports games comparison, and $260.
We're so old, dude. we are so old.
People are like on Wikipedia, like, what are you talking about? What is this?
Yeah.
But you know, that was
the
system.
My first console was the Intellivision. God, I wanted one of those. And the Atari, when that came out, my first console was the Magnavox Odyssey. Had three twist knobs that were built into the console itself, and that's what you played with.
It was probably mid-80s, right? Something like that?
Early 80s, I think.
Early 80s, What about MR? You have any experience or any thoughts around that? You know, Magic Leap, HoloLens?
Seen some of it, seen demos, experienced some of it. Part of what made me really skeptical about home VR is nobody's going to pay to look like a dork in their own living room, right? But you know, they managed to get it to a form factor where it's tolerable, and you look kind of dorky, but everybody's taking turns with it, excited about it. I haven't seen an MR experience that isn't just like grade A, 100%. You look like a dork, and you feel like a dork wearing it, and the experience is just from what I've seen, and I haven't seen everything, but I haven't seen an experience yet that's so compelling that I think, this is a mass market product.
Well, and the price point is a killer too, right? Because you know, I think the Magic Leap's what, $2,000 or $2,500, so that's a big ass to walk around with a computer size of a small frisbee around you, and the headset and everything.
Stuck to your head, and who's making games for it? And
I mean, it's more in the enterprise space, really. Yeah, that seems to be like the niche that they're finding, because the consumer is just too many barriers of entry.
You know, there's other lower tech stuff that I think is more interesting gameplay wise.
Okay.
You know, the obviously COVID and that is set the location based gaming.
Yeah.
Industry back a decade,
right.
if not more. But I think you can always look to parts of Asia, and kind of, it's like you're looking 5 years ahead in our games industry.
South Korea, especially.
I was in Taiwan a couple of years ago with my family, and the huge thing there at the time was called Pokemon Treta, and it was an arcade game, but it delivered these little kind of little collectible hockey puck like tokens that had different Pokemon on them.
Okay.
And so you would put a few bucks into the game and you would play it. And if you won, you'd get one of these. It was like you captured the Pokemon. And then you would collect them, and the game had these spaces on it for you to put those on there so that you bring your Pokemon collection to play this game.
Okay.
And you would put your Pokemon that you'd won using these trap.
Powered up.
I saw parents and kids lined up around the interior of a huge mall, and the parents are standing there with these like folios, these collection books of the kids' Treta collection. Wow. And as they're waiting in line to play the game, they're talking about what their strategy is going to be and what their combination of this can be. And this idea of having, you know, kind of the gameplay and the collectible toy where you're chasing the rare versions. And I could see something like that really being compelling here with the right IP and done right. I'd love to explore that at some point too.
I'm just seeing dollar signs too when you're thinking about all those all the pieces and all the things that they're collecting and lining up and everything. So what about like potential threats to the game industry? Like what are you concerned about?
Yeah, there are some things that I think a lot of people would consider threats that I think have a positive aspect to, you know, what's happening now with GDPR and COPPA and new law that just came out of the UK around protecting kids' privacy and that. Mm-hmm. For as somebody who's in the kids' game space, there's some risks there, particularly with poor and overzealous enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a glaring need for it. My fear is that, you know, whenever we get the latest moral panic around video games, and it's still, you know, it's still an easy target. If your poll numbers are down, then, you know, you can take a swipe at video games and blame it for society's ills, and you'll get sent for that.
Yeah, totally.
And that's how bad law gets made, and, you know, how we get stuck with regulation that just doesn't make sense. So I think that's a risk still.
Yeah,
surprisingly, I think that some of the more rapacious business models are not endearing the games industry to its customers.
Right.
I'm thinking of the, you know, the suburban couple who, for some reason, they've gotten hooked on Candy Crush, and now they're dropping, you know, $5,000 in a month on it, and their retirement savings is going into this.
Right.
There's a real problem with a business that is entirely predicated on the pursuit of whales and of getting big spenders to spend big, because you're going to net a lot of people who can't afford to spend big, but are still just as hooked. And, you know, so we saw some regulation around loot boxes come out. It was probably not probably a good idea. But I could see that really going overboard if the industry doesn't show more self-control and kind of ethical backbone.
What about opportunities that, like, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, in the industry in general, and if there's any silver lining to the coronavirus and, you know, kids being sent home from school and that, I think that a lot of the other players in the industry have woken up to what a huge untapped market there is in kids under 13. Now, if you're any game company that's in the top 50 grossing in the App Store, you already have a huge audience of kids under 13. They're just lying about their age to play your game.
Yeah.
Right. But I think that a lot of them have woken up to the fact now that we have all these kids playing our game. The regulatory environment is changing, and the FTC is going to start coming after us if we have what's obviously a kid's property, a Disney property or something, but we're calling it 13 plus in the App Store. That's not going to wash anymore. But I think they're starting to wake up to the fact that, wow, if we treat this player demographic well, then, you know, the big problem with games, of course, is discovery and user acquisition and all of that.
Yeah.
The Candy Crush players of of tomorrow are the Animal Jam players of today. Mm-hmm. If you build a relationship with that player and you treat them well with respect, and you get them involved in a gameplay community that they like and they trust, then yeah, you can graduate them into other games. Mm-hmm. What excites me right now is that I think that there's just huge, so much open water around WildWorks right now. I want more competitors. I want more people coming into the kid space and making high quality stuff for kids, you know, not games that are clearly aimed at kids, but they're pretending that they're adult games so that they don't have to comply with the regs. Okay. Making really good games for kids, you know, that are safe and follow the privacy regulations. I'm excited by all the business opportunity that's in you know, learning tools that are more game-like and not just slapping the gamification label on what's a bad learning app to begin with, but really taking virtual environments, persistent virtual environments, and turning them into learning spaces.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Some of the stuff Minecraft does, right?
Yeah,
more and more stuff it kind of bleeds into the educational space, and it's about exploring and building.
Yeah, we see that in the
Roblox. You know, Roblox.
Yeah, there's great potential to use those as education tools. Parents have to be aware that games like Minecraft and Roblox are not kids' games. They're adult games that, you know, if you just go in there and start playing and you're not kind of watching what your kid's doing, where they're going, they can wind up in a very adult experience. But it's something that, you know, they can be tremendous learning environments. And we see this in Animal Jam. We see teachers that are third grade teachers are giving up on Zoom and instead having their classes meet an Animal Jam because they can at least keep the kids' attention there.
Yeah, that's great.
I'd love to see, I think that we're going to have an opportunity to explore more of that, both in WildWorks and in the industry at large.
You mentioned COPPA a few times, and I remember that from my days at Midway and dealing with legal, and that's like Child Online Protection something.
Privacy Protection Act. Yeah, so that's the FTC does that in the U.S. It's a law that's now, it's pretty long in the tooth and really, unfortunately, it's only updated every 10 years and it really needs to be more frequent. But essentially what COPPA does is require verified parental consent for you to capture, store, use any data from somebody that you know or should know is under 13. Yeah.
And it's a big deal. And so is GDPR, right? I mean, that's European Privacy Act, where you have to disclose if you're hanging on to people's information and let them get out of it.
Yeah. There's a kids facet of GDPR called GDPRK. That's a set of regulations specifically around kids, and they define kids differently in different countries. Yeah. And GDPR applies differently to 15-year-olds in the Netherlands than it does to, you know, 14-year-olds in the UK.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. Was that granular?
It's that. And the scary thing about GDPR for companies that are not paying attention to it or not compliant that is, not only does it open you to, you know, the regulatory fines and action and that, but to civil suits. And those are company enders.
So the game industry, I'm sure you get a lot of them. What's a funny or odd story?
I'm sure you recall that the games industry used to be a much more ribald place. A lot of the way the business was done then, you certainly couldn't do now. And you know, and shouldn't. I think that there were a lot of kind of boys club abuses of that at the time, but
it had to evolve.
It had to grow up, but during its adolescence there was plenty of crazy stuff. And I talk about this sometimes with friends that, you know, there's that group of friends who really only see each other at game conferences two or three times a year, but you've known them for 20 years. So you kind of feel like you've developed a bond with them.
Right.
And you know, some of these are people that, you know, we reminisce of past GDCs or if you remember when DirectX first launched.
I was at the party. You're talking about the party.
You were at the party.
Yeah.
The infamous Alex St. John party with the Roman vomitorium and all that.
Yeah, the guar and the whole nine. Yeah. I was there. It was
There's no way any one facet of that party could be done now.
The whole thing
was just sick and wrong.
It was so bizarre because it was Halloween and it was like in all these like underground parking garages. It was like turned into a nightclub, and then it was like guar, and then there's just booze everywhere. And it was an expo floor. That's why I was there. But I was just like, it was surreal. I look back on it. It's like a fog. I'm like, did that really happen? And I've talked about it with somebody else on the podcast because it was like, that happened. And there is a little bit on the internet about it.
No, I have this very vivid memory of Alex. So Alex St. John was, as you probably remember, he was the head of Xbox at the time. And I think that what he spent on that party might have been deleterious to his career at Microsoft, because he didn't last much longer past that. But he was dressed Caesar and had, you know, these nymphs feeding him grapes while he's passing through the hallway, throwing gold coins that you could use to get drinks. And he wanted a Bacchanal and he got it. There are a lot of scenes like that from the early days of the industry, at least around when the industry got to the point where it was trying to have serious conferences, like part of Comdex being having the game developers conferences. Then it was wild and crazy to begin with.
I was telling somebody about this the other day. There was that period where Microsoft and Sony were like in an arms war every E3 to who could outspend the other guy and just throw the bigger party, you know. And there'd just be these crazy parties with like high profile bands and buses and sushi. Yeah. And there was that one Sony one where you went to a mountain by Dodger Stadium and they had built this whole.
I rode a
bus up this mountain, and you're looking out over LA, and there's like Eyed Peas. I think the Black
Eyed Peas. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was Macy Gray and the Black Eyed Peas.
And they had like midget Kiss, because they had like the Mexican wrestling. I mean, it was crazy.
I know. It was seriously like two fraternities competing with each other next door.
Oh yeah, bro. With 16 kegs.
Exactly. Exactly. With about that level.
Who is signing off on this? Yeah.
Did you go to the E3 move to Atlanta for a couple of years? Did you go to either of those? Yeah,
I was at both of those. Yeah, Sega had a party with Creeper Lagoon, and then the Foo Fighters crashed it after playing the Sony party like 2 a.m. And the Foo Fighters played for like 100 people because it was a smaller club. Creeper Lagoon wasn't a big deal. And it was like, wait a minute, that's Dave Grohl. And everyone was just trashed. And I ran into the bass player, Nate Mendel, in the stairs. And
those were pretty crazy ones.
Because pre E3 was CES, Consumer Electronics Show, had a wing or a section that was for gaming until, you know, broke off.
Well, and Comdex before the CES, when
computers.
When it was still called Comdex, and that was where, you know, Atari and 3DO and all those people came to show off the new consoles.
E3 goes cyclical, right? Because all of a sudden, it just at one point, everyone just stops and goes, "How much fucking money are we spending?" And they're like, "We're just going to start renting out hotels and just shuffle the press over there, and just and then it contracts, and then it kind of goes away, and then people are like, yeah, let's do that again, and it just kind of ebbs and flows, you know." And it's,
this was probably the bullet in the head that it is needed for the last couple of years. I don't see how it comes back from this, because it was kind of on life support already.
Right. So what about games you're playing right now that you're excited about?
My backlog is terrible.
Log in this game. I have 500 games to play. Damn.
Yeah, I'll tell you how terrible. I just like barely finished Control and Borderlands 3. I'm that far behind. So right now, the thing that's on top of my queue, and I haven't really gotten into it yet, is Last of Us 2. I'm excited to delve into that. Mobile stuff. We kind of had a family resurgence of Pokemon Go during the quarantine, and that was a lot of family walks to catch Pokemon. Which is kind of funny, because you know that app has been on my phone since 2016, but I don't think I'd opened it since then.
it was funny too, because it just exploded. Like when that first came out, you would just see people randomly walking, staring at the phones. And it's like, I know, you know, where did these people come from? And you would never see them before. And I remember driving through, you know, a small town at 1 a.m. and there's just people walking around like zombies with their phones. And it's like, yeah, this is culturally significant, right? It had like such a huge impact.
Yeah.
And kind of tired of it, or I don't know, but it, you know, obviously there's people still playing it, but it wasn't that everyone and their uncle were playing the type thing that
it had its period there. I think there's been something of a resurgence around COVID because it seems like, I mean, the numbers have certainly picked up, but
right,
you know, and I really genuinely, this isn't a plug or anything, I really enjoy jump in anonymously into our games, into Feral especially, since it's such a nascent young community right now, and there's so much creativity in it, and it's fun to be a fly on the wall in there.
You're right. Yeah, see what people are doing, like, oh, we never thought of that, or oh, that's cool they did that.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything I should have asked you about but didn't?
Oh, well, nothing that our attorneys would probably let me talk about. No, I, you know, for Wildworks, the whole essence of our company is making playgrounds. It's making playgrounds for kids specifically, and places where they can find fun, but with substance to it. And one of the first big crises that we had when we launched Animal Jam was, you have dens in Animal Jam where you've got kind of your own space that you can decorate, and you can take furniture items and arrange it, or have your friends come over.
Yeah.
And we had this basic table that everybody got as part of their first den, and we had these tiki torches that you could get in the game, and you could place them around your den. And some kid, there's always one on the playground, right?
Yeah, right.
Some kid figured out that I can put the tiki torch on top of the table and then jump on the table and tell everybody I'm pole dancing. And some kids would fill their dens up with tables with tiki torches in the middle, and so that we're having come to my pole dancing club, and we're like, oh my god, who would have thought of that?
Yeah, never.
How do you
years.
Catch that?
Right.
How do you catch that in test? And then we're just you know, we're waiting for the first parent to call and say, you know, my child's in your virtual strip club. What is going on here?
What is this? Yeah, what the hell is going on? Oh, that's crazy. Just laying those things out there and see how people combine it and what their imagination, good or bad, where it takes them. That
is really the fun part. And what they wind up having the most fun with is not what it's never been what we predicted.
Mm-hmm. Right. You just give them the tools and see what happens.
Yeah. It's like you spend millions of dollars developing a toy, and you know, it gets opened on Christmas morning, but they wind up playing with the box that it came in more.
Yeah. It's more interesting to them than the toy itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where can people find you online? You know, website, Twitter.
He's at wildworks.com. Feral is at fer.al.
Okay.
Animal Jam, of course, is in the App Store and at animaljam.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram, both at Clark Stacey. And love hearing from players on both of those. The Instagram one kind of overwhelmed me, and so our community team helps me keep up with that now.
Last question. What's one piece of advice you give others working in the industry right now?
There are a lot of them, but I think that it's got to be about the relationships that you develop, you know, what you do to be helpful for the people that are either trying to get into the industry or trying to figure the industry out. While it seems like it's this massive multi hundreds of billions of dollars industry, and it is, the community of developers really isn't that big. And the people that you meet, you're going to be working alongside them for the entirety of your career. They're going to be the people that you see every year at GDC, and some year you're going to be able to make an introduction for them that helps their company, changes their trajectory, and that stuff always comes back threefold to you. So if I give any advice, it would be look for ways to be helpful to everybody in the industry, even those that, especially those that don't seem to have anything to offer you in return, because you know, not only is that rewarding in itself, but you will be surprised at people would just rather do business with people like that, for one. And and two, you are putting karma in the bank. And
totally agree.
You always get much more out of it than you put into it.
I've said this many times in the show. The industry is a lot smaller than people think. So, you know, your deeds, your actions, how you treat people, no matter who they are or where they are in at a company or their profile or anything, that speaks to you as a person, and it stays with you, right? You know, so do the right thing, you know, help people out, you know, don't be a jerk. Just be that person that solves problems and is helpful, because those are the kind of people want to work with.
Yeah. Don't hoard knowledge. There's no point to it. I think probably 99% of the NDAs ever signed in the games industry are totally ridiculous and could totally be dispensed with, because the ideas, the underlying ideas are not, that's not what sells. That's not what makes a great game. It's the execution.
Totally.
And for the execution, you need people. And ideally, you need people from different backgrounds. People, different ages, different countries, you need different voices than people that you ordinarily interact with. I think especially now it's become, and I'm glad to see that it's become more of an issue in the industry, that we're trying to elevate voices that really have just been trampled over, and try to, find talent in places that we haven't looked for it. And it's already making the industry better, and we've got a ways to go there, but it all kind of ties back to that, look for ways to be helpful to other people.
You're right. The industry is getting better about it, but there's still a long way to go. People need to do that, reach out and help people that may be overlooked at normally in the industry, because it's just stupid stereotypes and people that are living in the past.
There's some cool new voices coming out of the industry, and we're already seeing new thinking on the indie scene. I'll throw in a bonus piece of advice.
Yeah.
Spend most of your time at GDC on the indie floor. You go to things like Casual Connect, go to their, their indie game competition that they have there. God, it's just, especially if you're, ancient guys like us who've been doing this for, 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
It's so galvanizing to feel that creative energy that's there, and that spirit of let's just try anything and see what sticks.
Yeah. It's exciting.
And if you can help somebody who's kind of in that spot, your own career is going to benefit from it, maybe in ways that you never even see the direct connection.
Right. Because, it's the karma thing, right? Well, excellent. I've had a great time talking tonight, Clark. Thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure, man. Thank you so much for doing it. I think the show is a terrific resource. I've really enjoyed, listening to some past episodes with folks that I know and folks that I don't know. I think it's great that you're kind of giving people in and outside of the industry a look behind the scenes at some of the personalities.
No, thank you. And I'm glad we got the introduction, because you and I have never met in real life, but we have, 60 plus shared connections on LinkedIn. So it was cool that we got a chance to talk tonight.
Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Go to the website at gamedevadvice.com, and you can find the show notes along with show notes for all the other episodes. Please also check out the new Patreon page at patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Have a lot of options up there for how you can support the show. Again, that's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks again for listening and being part of the show. Take care. Bye-bye.